Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Clean Tech podcast. Each week, our host David Hunt speaks to a leading startup CEO, executive, or thought leader in the clean tech sector. Focused on the clean energy and clean mobility transitions, each guest shares the highs and lows of their clean tech journey, their industry insights, and their vision and hopes for the future.
Hello, I'm David Hunt, CEO and founder of Hyperion Executive Search and your host for the Leaders in Clean Tech podcast. This week, my guest is a climate scientist, successful renewable energy entrepreneur and fellow podcast host. I'm delighted to be joined by Juliet Davenport. Juliet is the founder, former CEO and current non-exec director of the Good Energy Group PLC, a company that Juliet took public with a mission to power greener, cleaner future energy for all its customers. Juliet was Good Energy's CEO for 19 years. In 2013, she was awarded an OBE for services to renewables. She currently sits on the board of the Renewable Energy Association and Innovate UK and is vice president of the Energy Institute. In July 2020, she was appointed as a new board member for the Crown Estate. She is also the host of the Great Green Questions podcast. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Clean Tech podcast, Julia. It's great to have you join me.
Hi, David. Lovely to see you too.
Good. Now, listen, there's lots to get through, but as is traditional, if we could perhaps begin with Good Energy, where you spent a bulk of your time creating the company, a company in many ways ahead of its time, certainly a pioneer. Perhaps you can share a little bit of your background prior to founding the company, and then how and why you actually started Good Energy.
So it's interesting. So I guess I started life... I grew up in a very high carbon world. My father was a rallying co-driver, international rallying co-driver. So I spent a lot of time either on the side of, in the middle of a Welsh forest, watching very fast cars go past, or actually later on, he then ran touring cars. So on the side of a racetrack with very noisy cars and lots of emissions. So it wasn't necessarily the route most environmentalists might take. But I then went to university, and at university I studied physics, and there are many routes you can go in physics, but in my third year I got to study solid state, which is really typical, but also atmospheric physics. And atmospheric Right. physics was where I founded my interest in climate change, understood the science behind it, understood that this was a situation that we needed to do something about, and then spent a while, to be honest, trying to figure out how to get into the sector, because the sector didn't really exist at that point. It was very academic and very policy driven. So that I stood there going, I don't know what to do and I don't know how to do this, to be honest, at that point. And I then did various jobs. I was a temp for a while and then ended up with a full-time job in sports PR, which isn't a normal route into climate and climate science. I worked in a hotel for a while, which was a Caribbean hotel. That was an interesting experience, very good for one's building up of emotional intelligence. I did some teaching. I used to teach maths and physics for a while. And then I did an internship in the European Commission on energy policy. And that was really okay. when my kind of founding views on energy and the overall energy situation sort of started to really come to the fore. And I actually worked on gas and pipeline investment strategies and security supply. So looking at all the generation across lots of European countries, how they Right. were doing it and what it meant from a political point of view. But that was kind of my way in, I guess. And then I started, when I left the commission, I did actually work in the European Parliament for a short period of time on carbon taxation. So I know a reasonable amount about carbon taxation as well. And then I ended up working for a renewable consultancy. And a lot of that was very tech driven. So it was very much about the technical potential of all these different technologies in 30 European countries. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time it just never mentioned consumers or customers. It never considered the end user of these products. It just considered the output of them. And I think the energy sector has been like that for quite a while, in that sort of early stages of when I saw the energy markets, a lot of the CEOs would talk about delivering power to people's meters, not right. to people's homes. And the what was on the other side of the meter was kind of irrelevant. It was a standardized, you just assumed all consumers were the same, and of course they're not. And I think that was, it was the combination of climate change, understanding renewable technology and what potential it had, and then seeing the opportunity that there was a consumer gap, was really where my founding idea in terms of trying to do something on climate change. Mm-hmm. And I met an investor who very much shared the same vision. So he'd raised money in Germany to do something similar in Germany. Mm-hmm. And so he invested in the idea and I led that project in the UK. And in fact, I didn't actually run the company. I hired people then to run it because I didn't know, David, I'd been a teacher, I'd been an intern. I didn't know how to run and set up a company. So I kind of did it from the sidelines almost. And I hired a chairman, we hired a CEO. And eventually it was a little while before I then took over. And actually it was when the German investor went bust and the existing CEO went in a different direction that I refounded Good in a sense, right. in around 2002. So it was an interesting journey. And I don't think any entrepreneurs can ever say that their early stage of their journey is as they planned, because it so isn't.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And also, I think what's really great, I mean, I think this is about the 70, must be approaching the 80th episode, and no two founding stories are the same in terms of how the entrepreneur got to be where they started. And as you say, nobody's journey is ever linear or expected. But it is really interesting to say you kind of almost, an entrepreneur or a business leader by, no, I won't say by accident necessarily, but by certainly not by, complete design.
No. I didn't go out there and get an MBA, and I didn't. I was really about the science. That's where it started. I mean, I did look and see whether I should go into the science. But to be honest, I don't think that's where my forte was. Policy was fascinating, and policy still fascinates me today, because obviously it creates the framework for businesses to operate in. And if you get the policy right, then the businesses will come. Yeah. And so policy still influences the energy market hugely in the UK, which is why Good has been so involved in it over the last 20 years. But actually running a business is incredibly creative. And I think I didn't have the confidence to actually set it up and run it myself initially. But after a while, I saw that it wasn't rocket science. And it's... you could, as long as you're up for learning and understanding what business can do and how you can run it and what structure it needs, and you've got some great advisors, then actually it's really freeing, because you can be incredibly creative and come up with new propositions.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we did a crowdfund before crowdfunding was a thing. We didn't really think of it. We just did it. We gamified all our original tariffs before we really understood what gamifying was. We just made it work. And so that's what you do at those early pioneering stages, is just make things happen to make sure that you can deliver a proposition that you think consumers are going to want.
Yeah, I think that sometimes it's really helpful to actually not know what you can and can't do, or what's doable. I think too often, if you don't know what's not possible, then why don't you just go out and do it? And I think that's, I think sometimes they're quite a healthy way to be creative and not to be stymied by the textbook kind of routes to do anything.
Completely. And I think that's when you try and make sure you surround yourselves by good advisors, whether it's a board or whether it's a sort of mentor, somebody to give you the freedom to be able to create, because that's what you absolutely need. But at the same time, making sure you've got those real tipping points or those real sort of bear traps that you can avoid, because that's what you need. You need to be able to navigate, have the freedom to create, but navigate some of the big problems. And I mean, in the early stages, there was a period when the German company went into administration. We were very close at that point. And you learn, first of all, you learn very fast at that point. And secondly, you need somebody who's got a steady hand, who knows what to do in those situations. And that's definitely, we had a great board for that at the time, who kept us on the straight and narrow.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's invaluable, as you say, to have people who have been there and seen and done things, and you can learn from their mistakes and experiences and grey hairs and wisdom and all the rest of it. And I think that's interesting, whatever stage of company you are, to have, whether it's personal mentors and or sort of board or business advisors that can help you through those crises, which come thick and fast at times.
Mm. Completely. And I think those are the trick is not to ask your boards or your advisors to do your job. Mm. The trick is to get them to mentor and help you and support you and be there for you when you need it. But at the same time, it is the CEO's responsibility or the founder's responsibility to get on and deliver the products that you need.
Yeah, yeah. So what were some of your biggest challenges then at that time? Because as you say, you weren't necessarily a trained CEO as such, or you had good advisors around you. But on a personal view, having stepped from a sort of an eclectic career to date, what were some of the sort of the personal challenges in those early years that were standout?
Yeah. So there were definitely certain things that came easier to me. I mean, anything that included a spreadsheet and figuring out sort of the commerciality of propositions, how you could communicate things, how you could develop new ideas, all of that was pretty straightforward for me. I found that very simple. Mm-hmm. I think the things I found more tricky was understanding a balance sheet and what the important was and how investors would look at a business, and some of the more kind of accounting treatments of a business. Mm. Those are probably the areas that I knew very little about at the beginning. I mean, you don't just pick those up generally as you wander through life. Those are something you actually need to put some effort into and to learn. So I think that was part of it. But the rest, I mean, is fairly, if you know the area, you know the technologies. I guess I had an innate sense of consumer. Mm-hmm. That again, I mean, but consumer research, you discover a lot. But also, I think sometimes just listening to customers, being on the end of a phone, being part of a call center, just hearing what they're saying, and I think that came fairly naturally to me as well.
Yeah. I mean, so much has changed in this period of time. On one hand, things like customer experience, where we're so much now more focused on being able to collect that data and have those conversations and be actually far more aware of what happens on the other side of the meter, as you put it. But equally, the energy and technology world has changed significantly. I founded my solar business in 2007. And obviously, we were kind of viewed as hippies at the time with no idea about business. And clearly, this was before feed-in tariffs and all the rest of it. Now, good energy at the time were in existence, and they were quite an inspiration at the time. Just thinking about it, there are people who can create a business in this sector. But clearly, the sector as a whole has evolved so fast and so dramatically over that 10, 12, 20-year period. How has good energy evolved, again, from those early stages of, I'm not sure what your customer base was in the first couple of years, but clearly now, not just as a listed company, but as a sort of, a stalwart of the clean energy market?
Yeah, so I think in those early days, right at the beginning, when we were going through our sort of ups and downs with our investor, we had about 2,000-3,000 customers. So we were super small. And that was one of the reasons why we were sort of trying to figure out what is the business model going forward. Yeah. And I guess we were just an electricity business as well. So we were 100% pure electricity business. And we then started to, I guess, we diversified into business customers as well early on, but not seriously. So they were about 10 or maybe 20% of our total customer base within the first 10 years. It's only till recently where really we've accelerated business customers as we've seen the demand for business customers come forward with ESG and the UN targets and a lot of businesses really going on the front foot of setting themselves a zero carbon target. So that's been an evolution. By 2008, we were selling gas. And part of the reason for that was our customers wanted to buy both fuels from us. And we recognized that gas was obviously a fossil. But so we looked at how can we support other areas? So we looked at supporting solar thermal, we supported biomass heating systems in the UK, and we did some offsetting. So we tried to really promote renewable heat in the UK as well as being able to sell gas. And then I think the feed-in tariff was, we were early stage, and we set up HomeGen, which was that original way that people who generated power in their own homes could get value for that power. Because at the time, a lot of the big players were just cutting off small generators. And we saw a marketplace in that and pioneered that. And I guess we have, we had about 1,000 small generators at that point. And today we've got nearly 200,000. Yeah. So that's been a major part of the business and really important to us, actually, because the whole point of GUD is to promote a future where we build more renewables. I mean, that's what we're about. And then we did actually invest in doing our own generation. Yep. So I think between 2012 and 2000, I mean, we bought Delabole back in 2004. So we always operated a renewable site, but we developed about 150 megawatts of solar and wind assets between 2012 and 2016.
Crazy times, weren't they?
So that was, it was a crazy time. But that was also incredibly interesting to see what the barriers were to getting some of these sites away, but also what really worked. And we had a pretty, I think we had a 100% planning record at that point. And it was a lot of consumer engagement. It was finding great sites, getting out there and getting passionate people on the road, talking to people. And that was really exciting.
I guess, Sherry, it's a theme that's come across. I mean, clearly, CEOs and founders come in all shapes and sizes, and rightly so. But there are many who are kind of very happy behind a desk in a sort of almost like a conducting fashion. There are others who want to get in amongst the weeds. And it sounds like you've been very much the latter in terms of, particularly with customer engagement.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you try and do as a CEO, and that's what I've tried to do over the years, is to, you need to empower people to do things, but you also need to understand the dynamics of the business, the dynamics of what's going on either in the energy markets or in consumers' homes, because that's how you can really support and challenge your teams to go, well, are we doing enough for these consumers? Are we challenging ourselves? We can't just go down the computer says no route. We have to kind of think outside the box and go, well, if we can't do it that way, can we do it this way? And I think as a CEO, your job is to try and stay at 30,000 feet. But occasionally you do have to go in and have a look. And the more I meet kind of CEOs who've really been involved in innovative businesses, that seems to be a case. You can't just stay up at the top. You have to look, go deep as well.
So in terms of the growth, and one thing that challenges CEOs and founders during the course of growth, fast growth is challenging and it's expensive and it's hard to manage. So fundraising typically becomes an issue, whether that's through VCs early on, PE, and of course, there's always the option of listing, which is, again, quite favourable at the moment because of the market conditions. But you chose to list at a time where perhaps it wasn't quite so easy to do so as a renewable energy company. What led you to choose that as a way of funding growth, future growth?
Well, it's interesting because essentially we were, we did three crowd funds, maybe it was even four, I can't remember, and I would say about 75% of the company was actually owned by our customer base as a result of that. So we were quite unique, and we looked at lots of different models in terms of what the future model could be. We did look at the cooperative model because obviously we were partially customer owned. That was actually what was fascinating about the cooperative model. It was very difficult to transfer a business with a public makeup as we were to become a co-op. And even harder than to go and raise money when you needed it to invest in the business. And it was fascinating because co-ops seemed to work very well if you weren't in that real dynamic stage, if you were kind of a big existing organization. Yep. But if you were like us, then it didn't work. So we did talk to some PE, we talked to various other organisations, but a lot of them didn't really have a long-term vision. So I remember having a conversation with one private equity, which is basically saying, well, we wanted drag and tag right, which meant that they could force us to sell out of the company within two to 3 years. And our vision was to create this long-term market, not to create a business that then was going to be sold. So listing felt like the best option at that point. And I have to say, it has its downside in the sense that it's expensive, takes quite a lot of time, and the CEO needs to spend a lot of time with investors. Yeah. So it did change my role. And sometimes I regretted that because I could stop being the inventor in the corner. I ended up having to go out and be the investor. But I learned a huge amount from the investors as well. I mean, when they challenge, they bring lots of insight. And that's where we end. So we raised money on that as a platform, AIM as a platform. But at the same time, and we probably, my most successful fundraising was through our green bond that we issued when we were doing the original investment in developing assets. But the other thing that is quite interesting about running a listed company is that you do focus on governance, and sometimes that feels a bit heavy for a small business. But I also think that it gives you a certain amount of discipline as an organization, and you stay on the right side of things, and you make sure that you're not suddenly cruising into a sort of a bit of an argument with your auditors. You do have to talk a lot about what you're doing, but at the same time, there's no surprises, and I think that was really quite good, and I think I really appreciated that, and I think as a result, the business has always been very well run.
I think that's an interesting thought, actually. I think for all entrepreneurs, it's great to have that freedom. And the reason a lot of us do it is because, you know, you are in control, you know, to some extent, and you do have that sort of creative urge to be able to be, I guess, agile in your thought processes. But I think accountability, however that looks, is really important, whether that's from a mentor, a board, or I should say from investors. But like you say, sometimes it's good to be kept reasonably on track, as long as it doesn't stifle the business too much.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. And also, I think the interesting point there, as soon as you start to take on board external money, and again, however that looks, whether that's crowdfunding, VC, PE, or listing, both your role as a founder CEO changes dramatically, and sort of the amount of time that then is allocated to those relationships as opposed to what you were doing before, which perhaps, again, was a bit more creative.
Yeah. And I think that's a real watch out for a CEO, because you just need to go into that with your eyes wide open. And you need to consider whether either you should change your role or you need to invest heavily in investor relations and have somebody who can really lead that for you and support it, so that you don't have to spend. It's not that you don't talk to investors, but you, with a specialist investor relations role, they can think about the story that you're telling. And that's always quite tricky. Sometimes FDs aren't brilliant at doing that, and it falls back on the CEO, which means that you end up doing a lot of that. So I think when I look back on it, to be honest, by the time I stepped down, I think we sorted it and we got there. We had a great story to tell to the city. We had a great sort of head of investor relations who was fantastic and was brilliant at just making sure that I could tell the story and it added up all the way through effortlessly without me having to kind of really dig in and ask a lot of questions of the FD.
Yeah, super. I think a couple of the challenges for founder CEO, one we've touched on there, which is fundraising and that how that changes the nature of the role. But now you've stepped down. And again, that's the other thing of how you step away from the baby that you bore or created. Yeah. Whether that's, again, however you exit, you've exited. So I appreciate you're still an NED. But how challenging was that for you to make that decision? And how have you found letting go of the reins to an empowered CEO?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I think I'm still part of the way through it, to be honest, David, but we'll see how it goes. I mean, I don't see it as a baby anymore. I mean, it's 20 years old. It's got smelly socks, and I'd be quite happy for it to go and wash its own smelly socks. And so it's a kind of teenager grown up, gone to university and graduated. And although it's nice to see it every now and then, I don't want to look after it anymore.
That's a good analogy. I've not seen that one before.
So, I mean, I'm hoping I'll rather enjoy it, to be honest, because being on the board, obviously I know the business inside out. I know the bear traps, which I hope I will help the new CEO with. I'll be able to kind of, I'll do what I like doing, which is looking at the horizon, thinking long-term strategy, which is where my kind of sweet spot is. And I hope that I can help sort of just be there to provide the history, but also to give the watch out signs in terms of projects and areas and the overall industry, because I understand the industry inside out.
Yeah.
I'm kind of hoping, and then I've just got to sort out what else I do. And I am genuinely inquisitive. I am curious and I'm fascinated by things. I like being asked difficult questions I don't always know the answer to, because I will then go and find out what the answer is. So I'm quite excited about this next stage, because I hope that I can work with businesses that I don't know everything about, but I can find more about as soon as I can.
Yeah, well, that leads on nicely, because that's one of the things I wanted to sort of cover with you, because again, as we sort of talked about, back in sort of the 2000s, when we were, this market was entirely different, we were laughed at for being sort of a cottage industry and hippies and worse. But since then, we've seen the rise and rise of both solar and wind, which to me at the time seemed really obvious, even though again, not to many. I certainly didn't foresee in the same way the rise of batteries as they have done, and energy storage and electric vehicles 10 years ago. Going back to your rallying days, I used to love watching the Group B rally cars race around, and didn't ever foresee that they would one day be powered by batteries, but clearly this is where we are now with Extreme E is literally happening, or very similar to. So the energy and mobility transitions continue to both converge and grow. So where do you see the biggest challenges and opportunities for, I guess, future impact entrepreneurs or for the companies you're hoping to support in the future? What does the next few years look like in your mind?
So I think I want to, I probably will have quite a lot focused on energy, but I might branch out into some other areas that cover sustainability and environment generally. Innovation and technology is kind of core to what I'm interested in as well. So I am in, but young entrepreneurs as well. I've done a bit of mentoring. So NatWest runs a climate, an accelerator, and they've just brought in a few climate young entrepreneurs. So that's really interesting, seeing people at the beginning of their journey. I also work with an organisation called Huckletree, which does something very similar. Those sort of dabbling in some of those smaller areas. And then the wider areas, I'm fascinated by the energy transition and some of the challenges for the big fossil companies, because how they rearrange their, how they get off the habit, I think is going to be a really interesting journey. So that's really interesting. And then sort of branch out into sort of new areas that I haven't been involved in before. As I said, I'm generally pretty curious. I like looking at challenges and transformations and figuring out ways through them. I think I'm definitely at a time when I want to do it as an advisor, whether it's non-exec director roles or advisors to different organizations. I might do another exec role sort of in a while, but for now I think this will be quite fun just to broaden my horizons.
Yeah, step back. And again, I think that's useful sometimes to be able to step back and look at the bigger picture without committing yourself entirely, as you say, to another executive role, but to just to see, because it's so phenomenally dynamic, that both the mobility and energy transitions. And the fossil fuel, I mean, obviously, was it week before last where we had both the Shell court case in the Netherlands and the shareholder issues with Exxon and was it Chevron, which were absolutely fascinating. And I really, really almost sympathise, I say almost, with some of these oil and gas companies in terms of how they rearrange their business models, and if they can avoid all of the stranded assets and everything else that they're potentially burdened with. But we need them on side, I think. But it's how and well they can do that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we do need them on side. But I think, I mean, I did a piece of work on this many years ago at the RSA, where we did it's a piece of work using a methodology called constellations, which is meant to help with complex problems. And it actually came out of therapy, but they've used it now for quite a lot of complex corporate decision making. And some of the questions we put up was, how do environmental organisations like Greenpeace and other campaign organisations work with the fossil industry to transform it? And there was quite a lot of work in the room, but what was interesting is we ended up that businesses like Good were incredibly important in that transformation, because they could shine a light on showing the way for some of the bigger fossils who've been in different business models.
Yeah.
But also what became apparent is that some of those fossil industries would fall by the wayside because they didn't make the transition.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we'll see, is I think we'll see some of the progressive organisations really move forward and work fine. And then, but you'll still have organisations that are slightly stuck in the past, who can't give up their fossil balance sheet, and will find the transition really, really hard.
Yeah, yeah. And talking of being stuck in the past, it's something I also wanted to touch on with you, is that broadly, I think those of us who are in the clean tech sector like to think of ourselves as somewhat enlightened and egalitarian, and brilliant people I work with day to day and have done for many years in the sector. But we still have a diversity issue. And
yes.
I wondered what your thoughts were on how we can address that and why it might be.
I sigh. I'm sorry, David. I've been working on the diversity issue for quite some time now. I mean, partially because, to be honest, work is more fun if you have a diverse workforce and you have anything you get involved in.
Yep.
But also because I do think it's extremely important to make sure that we deliver a future energy system that is fit for all. And I guess the challenges are really around the industry. So I think they're multiple, and that's part of the issue. And so you can't control all of the challenges in one place. So the first challenge is that we still have very few female graduates in the STEM subjects, mm-hmm. but particularly the engineering and mathematics areas, which is where the feeder stock for a lot of the energy industry has come from.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean we only need engineers and mathematicians, but they are quite an important mainstay of this industry. And I also think that we don't see enough hybridization on courses, and we're beginning to see, actually. I was speaking to somebody at Durham University where they actually bring together science and some of the arts, because what we seem to be producing from some of the traditional universities at the moment is people who specialize in arts and people who specialize in science. Mm. And in some of the universities, you've even got the science park where all the scientists go off to a completely different part of the university. And what that means is you have a bunch of scientists who don't learn how to communicate, and you have a bunch of artists who have no idea about science. And our planet is going to survive because we bring those two together, not because we separate them. And I think that, for me, is a fundamental of diversity, is because it's not just about, we need to see diversity of thought.
Yep.
And right now, whether it's where you come from or what gender you are, does seem to divide between those two subjects, and we need to see cross-pollination across it all.
Yeah, no, so I think, and also as a diversity of backgrounds and however you want to refer to it, as sort of social backgrounds as much as anything else.
Completely.
It's interesting. I think the RSA, amongst other organisations, I think are interesting, where you do get an eclectic mix of people with an entirely different sort of academic and or professional experience come together and try and solve or talk about problems.
Yeah. And it is really important. And what tends to happen is that certain problems only get talked about in certain forums. And so after a while, if that's the only place you hear from them, you slightly marginalise it, particularly if it's not engaging with solving the problem. It's just engaging. So if you see, for example, fuel poverty just from the point of view of a regulatory requirement, then you're never going to be innovative about solving the problem.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge. That's what we need to break down, those barriers between them.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting thought. And again, I think there's a little bit of, I'd say navel gazing as such, but again, going back to the fact that we're in this clean tech bubble and most people are kind of sit on the similar wavelength. There might be a few discrepancies along the way, but broadly, you all have the same mindset. But it's the rest of the, you know, it's almost like 80% of the population aren't in this little bubble that we exist in, and we have to bring them into the conversations.
Great.
Yeah. Well, it's been super to talk to you, and we could go on forever. I'd always like to close out, Juliet, with a little bit of what's inspired you in your journey along the way, whether that's books, thought leaders, podcasts, or anywhere that maybe either you go to when it's challenging and you go for a bit of inspiration, or things that have started you on your journey.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think the starting on my journey was my university course and studying. So that's probably quite introverted in the way that I started. I think there were people inspired. I went to this amazing conference in Oxford in about 2007, where it brought together artists and scientists from across the UK to talk about climate change. And that was pretty amazing. I think Ian McEwan and Philip Pullman, some amazing writers were there, and then some amazing scientists were there as well. So I think you need that kind of place to come together to be inspired every now and then to keep you kind of moving forwards. I think Greta Thunberg has seriously inspired me in the last few years to see that generation coming through, and the power of her voice is amazing. And then I go to for my kind of, I guess, entrepreneurial fix is I do listen to a podcast called How I Built This, which by Guy Raz. I love it.
Yeah.
I love hearing other people's stories, particularly in any sort of business. Particularly because so many of them start off in the same way as we did, which is you didn't have a business, and suddenly you didn't have a business. You create something from nothing. There was no money. You went from hand to mouth for a period of time, and then it becomes something that's large and established. And hearing that story time and time again is just so exciting.
Yeah. From different contexts. That's one of the things that inspired me to start this podcast, is obviously it's focused on clean tech, but just that, so the breadth of how we got to be where we are, it's almost like magic to some extent, but it's creativity, isn't it? That you know, you create from nothing something.
Yes.
And hopefully in our world, at least, we do good with that. But huge, that's a great podcast, by the way. So what I'll do is in the episode link to this podcast episode, we'll put a link to that. I'm sure a lot of people will be familiar with it anyway, and of course links to Good Energy and to your own website, because I know you do a lot of things again in and outside of,
and in fact we just launched our own podcast, Great Green Questions, which I have also really enjoyed doing, because I learn about things I don't necessarily know about. So it's not just on energy, it can be on a whole wide range of things, including food and agriculture. And So that's been really interesting. I actually do have listened to it, because when you're, I don't know about you, David, but when you're chairing a podcast or presenting a podcast, you don't always listen to it in the same way as you do when you hear it once it's recorded.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've learned phenomenally. And they say you try and pick up some as you go along, but definitely listening to it or reading the transcripts afterwards, you think there's some amazing insights that you pick up from conversations like this. And it's important to go back. So we'll certainly put a link to the Great Green Questions podcast as well in the episode page, and hopefully that will continue. But like you say, it's a great fun and a privilege to just to talk to people about stuff that's fascinating.
Yes, it is.
So
thank you, David.
Long way you continue, but no, great to have talked with you. I look forward to seeing where you end up next and the rest of your journey. But thanks for everything you've done with Good Energy, inspiring so many companies in the UK at least along the way. And great to have spent some time with you.
Thanks, David. Speak soon.
Thank you for listening, and especially to those of you who subscribe to the podcast. I hope you enjoyed another great founder story. Please do continue to share episodes amongst your community online and directly with those that you feel could have an interest. And again, it would be really appreciated if you could take a few moments out to write a review on Apple Podcasts or your platform of choice. Hugely appreciated, and look forward to speaking to you on an episode soon.